a foreclosure, even for some of the worst properties, is not the desired outcome for any player. The banks, believe it or not, don't want foreclosures because they don't want REO if they can avoid it. The people living in the house, they don't want to get kicked out of their home. And certainly society and the neighborhood doesn't want to see this foreclosure happen either. So if foreclosure is not the desired outcome for any player, then maybe there's something we ought to be doing about it because the market's not working the way it should.
Welcome to the Alta Group Podcast on Real Estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is Jaffer Husnain, co-founder and managing partner of Lifeline, a private equity firm with a singular focus to buy distressed single-family homes in short sales. Jaffer was previously an international economist with Citicorp and senior vice president at AllianceBernstein, where he focused on real estate, sovereign wealth funds, and global central banks. Jaffer, thanks for joining us today. I want to open up by asking you to provide us with some historical context for this recession. You were with Goldman Sachs and then Citibank and then Merrill Lynch, and in many ways, you had a front row seat when the RTC spent $125 billion to relieve the financial institutions of all of the distressed real estate. And I wanted you to offer us a comparison between what you saw then and what you're seeing now.
You know, I did have a pretty front row seat on that. And I'd say that, you know, superficially, there are similarities. I mean, there's financial distress, there's financial rationing, there's, until not too long ago, rather a sharp divergence in credit spreads and real just good old-fashioned credit rationing. The differences are in magnitude, in the diffused nature of the problem. Back in the RTC era, there were certain very well-defined pools of problem assets that the RTC was created. Now, you know, I'll freely grant, in hindsight, particularly when things have worked out well, we tend to gloss over all the difficulties and all the, you know, all the heart stoppages, et cetera, et cetera, and the near-death experiences. But it is a little different now. The problems are much broader. The asset classes are much larger. Residential real estate is a significantly larger asset class.
Yeah, there's about $15 trillion in residential mortgages and another about $2.3 trillion of home equity.
And it's not just large. It is psychically important. You know, it's a house. It's not a strip mall. A strip mall getting cut in half means the developer has a really hard time and the bank does really poorly. But a house going down 40, 50% means there's an individual, there's a family that feels that much poorer, and they may be the best credit in the world, but if they bought a house in the last few years, by definition, if they're selling now because they're moving or whatnot, they've got a huge problem.
And so it's really interesting. What you're doing as an opportunity investor is quite different. The London-based firm Preqin put out a report that says that there's about $93 billion of private equity capital that probably won't deploy till 2010. It's about 100 funds. But most of it is on the commercial real estate side. And yet you're focusing on residential and not multifamily, but single family.
Correct. You know, and understand that my heritage, my training is entirely on the institutional side of the business, on the buy side. And that's the mindset I brought to this. When we looked at the problem, which to me is, of course, in commercial real estate, but the real problem that I think is shaking the economy is on the residential side. You know, we started to think about what could be some solutions to the problem that would make sense. And it got us to thinking in very classic terms of, you know, why did this problem occur? And I don't mean because banks overlent or the U.S. consumer, as they pretty much always do in aggregate, tend to pick the option that is the worst for the bank and the best for them. By the way, you can test that out at any point in time. It's always been true. The U.S. consumer is much smarter in aggregate than we may realize, or that banks in particular may realize. That was a lesson from 1991, 1997, 1987, et cetera. But look, the residential area is where the problem to us was from an economic standpoint, from a social standpoint. You know, a bunch of us who knew the real estate business well, but also knew the broader markets, looked at the problem, saw what the problem was, and then, you know, not to be obtuse, came up with a solution.
So give us a sense of what that solution is. You have three funds, correct?
Initially, they all key off of the same premise. And it's important to talk about what's going on in the real world because, you know, our funds are real property funds. And they key off of something that's pretty obvious, which is that there is a good old-fashioned market failure in single-family homes. Here's what I mean by that. Foreclosure is the outcome when a mortgage can't be paid and it can't be modified, et cetera, in extremis. The reality is a foreclosure, even for some of the worst properties, is not the desired outcome for any player in this discussion. What we have built is, I believe, one of the first, if not the first, institutional scale, single family residential investment in the U.S. that can be done to scale. So that, you know, as you were saying earlier, when people talk about real estate, they've always talked about commercial. And even within commercial, when they're talking residential, they're really talking multifamily. Why? Because that's the easiest one to acquire. Single family homes have been really hard to buy, right? We have cracked that nut. Right? It's very simple, you know, and this happens all over the country, right? Three folks get together, pool a little bit of money, go out and buy some houses, rent them out. That's been done. What we are doing is we are taking that model at a time when society needs it, and we've institutionalized it. We've been able to acquire these properties at scale in a very efficient, very objective, formulaic manner, and that's the secret sauce. The good thing is we recognize that secret sauce, and as good former engineers, we sought and applied for a patent around that process.
So this is the pricing model you're referring to.
And it's more than the pricing model. It's the acquisition of property model. See, because the concept of raising a bunch of money on the one hand and then going out and buying property, that's not new, right? What is new, A, is that property's definition is single family homes, and B, that we can buy it at scale. We can buy them in big chunks working with the banks. Now here you've got to be very careful that, you know, there are privacy laws, there are very strict legal barriers here that we are very conscious of. We are a very socially responsible fund.
So, Jaffer, take me through the process of how you work with a bank or with a special servicer.
Very early on when we were designing our product and our process, we realized that the best way would be for us to work with banks or servicers or anybody who had a pool of mortgages that they were trying to avoid foreclosure on. So the way it works is, in practice, we have a very objective set of criteria that will define what we will look at, right, in terms of the house. That's a first cut, very objective, extremely formulaic. We give that query, if you will, in database terms, to the bank. And while we're talking to some very large banks, we're also talking to very small banks and credit unions. Some of our best product, dare I say, comes from those folks because they really care about trying to keep people in homes. So they will run our criteria through their near foreclosure book. Once the bank or financial institution or servicer comes to the realization that they've crossed the line where a foreclosure is likely on a particular house, then what they will do is they will look at that particular house, and then the bank or some third party, not us in particular, from a legal standpoint, it's very important that that be noted, they will approach the homeowner to say, listen, it's unfortunate, but you're going to get foreclosed on. We will try to modify you, right? Because that's by definition a great outcome. If you can get low-cost money from the government, fantastic. But if that's not possible, and if there is a way in which you would like to stay in your home, then maybe these people at Lifeline Assets could help you. That person or that family then has to make a formal application to us and provide us with a little bit more information as well as the indication that they're interested in this. And what we have then done is we will then run a very objective secondary screen that then conducts an appraisal, and much of this is automated, by the way. At that point, if all those screens are met, that person is made an offer to. And what that offer really is a streamlined, formulaic, top-down short sale. In a nutshell, what we have figured out is how to institutionalize the short sale process and make it really efficient and really transparent so that when a bank gets a short sale, typically what happens is a bank gets a short sale, bank spends, you know, X number of months, X could be 2 months, X could be 6 months or more. Meantime, the buyer is sitting around twiddling their thumbs and then walks away. And you can understand why banks would do that, because they may not know the location, they may be based out of the area, they may want to do a good job, and they may legitimately worry that if they say yes to one short sale and no to the other, they leave themselves open to legal recourse. We show up with a very formulaic way to do a short sale, pre-approved by the bank on a formula level, so that when the bank does go in and present Lifeline to the near foreclosure homeowner, they have almost pre-cleared the process, so that if the person and the house are approved by our objective process, then the short sale can occur very quickly.
Is there a bid-ask gap on the residential side?
That's, you know, we've been putting this together for about a year now. And for the most part of that year has been spent talking to banks. We have not heard, not one bank has pushed back to say, oh, your offer doesn't look too good. We're much better off on our own.
And to extend the analogy with commercial real estate, in an environment when nobody can sell a home, do you have a problem with valuations?
We do. But what we're doing, take a step back. We are taking an asset, which is the house, and a person who used to own the own house. And, you know, one thing, going back to how smart U.S. consumers are, if they realize they're way out of the money on their mortgage, they're quite aware they don't really own the home, that in fact the bank owns the home, and that they're just paying a significantly more than they should rental on a house that is a convenient fiction that they own. The fact is, the U.S. consumer viscerally knows they don't own the home anymore, and they're looking to save cash each month. So we need to, that's an important point. But, you know, the fact is that when it comes time to, quote, get a mark-to-market on that home, right, in an environment where there's no liquidity, what do you need? You need something like a pricing mechanism. What, in fact, we've created as part of this process is a price discovery mechanism. I wouldn't say that it's, you know, this is not rocket science, fellas, but it is a very objective, sensible way for us to figure out what we are willing to pay for a particular house where the former homeowner agrees, and this is important, to continue to live in that house and in a very socially transparent manner continue to take care of it.
Now, what's different about your fund is that you will only buy homes where the occupant agrees to stay in the house.
Part of our offer